You're listening to Peel Talks Housing, the Region of Peel's podcast delving deep into complex issues around affordable housing and homelessness and efforts to help residents get and keep housing. Episodes will feature residents with lived experience, Region of Peel staff, our partners, academics, policymakers, and other leading voices in the affordable housing sector. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of the Region of Peel or the direction provided by the Region of Peel's Council. Hello and welcome to Peel Talks Housing. My name is Axel Villamil and I'm your host today. Today's topic of discussion is housing and inequality, racism, and systemic discrimination. We are joined today by two amazing guests, and I'll let them introduce themselves.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sharon Floyd. I am the CEO of Embrave Agency to End Violence, an organization that has been providing shelter, support, counseling, and advocacy to survivors of gender-based violence in the Region of Peel for over 40 years.
Amazing. Thank you. Douglas.
Hi there. My name is Douglas Kwan. I'm the Director of Advocacy and Legal Services at the Advocacy Center for Tenants Ontario. We're a community legal clinic funded by Legal Aid Ontario to advance tenants' rights across the province.
Some amazing talent and experience in the room today. I wish it was in person. I wish I could be sitting here with you, but it's cold out. And also, you know, just the whole pandemic situation happening. But I'd like to get right into it. Discrimination, that topic, that word period is just a loaded term. How would you both define it?
Yeah, for me, I would just describe it as the inequitable treatment of a group or individuals because of their identity. And I see that discrimination can be experienced systemically or structurally as well as interpersonally. And the impact of discrimination, depending on whether it's structurally or systemically or interpersonally, is different for folks. How I define structurally and systemically is really looking at the policy frameworks, the rules and regulations that limit folks' access to services and supports. And at an interpersonal level, from my perspective, you're looking at those microaggressions and people's individual experiences with representatives of those systems.
I couldn't have said it any better than what Sharon described discrimination as. It's absolutely.
Great definition. Great, great, great way of explaining it. Again, I also agree because Sharon's always on point from what it sounds like. I would like to talk about, is there a disconnect too between how people understand discrimination and who is impacted by it?
I think from a academic or third-party observer point of view, I think discrimination can be clearer than when you're being impacted personally. Sharon speaks about microaggressions, and that's often how discrimination manifests itself. And those who are living in our society who, you know, from an outsider point of view, are being discriminated against, are victims of those microaggressions, may not themselves feel that they're being discriminated against because of some of the systemic processes and barriers that society has put in place. Whereas, one example is, not having representation in the boardroom may cause individuals to feel that there's no place for someone of their race or their background or their sexual orientation, and that they don't belong in that boardroom because they don't see themselves in that leadership position.
I also believe that that there's a disconnect because of the fact that people's experiences are based on their lens and their identity. So, when we look at our entire selves, there are parts of us that we see as marginalized. For example, as a Black woman, there's parts of my identity that I see as marginalized, and then there's parts of my identity that I see as privileged. When I'm looking at my experiences, I'm looking at my entire experience, and I'm looking at the lens of marginalization, and I'm looking at things through the lens of privilege. So depending on the experiences that I'm having, or for those folks that we are supporting, for example, at Embrave, depending on their intersecting identities, if there's someone from a marginalized sexual orientation or a person living with a disability or, you know, a racialized individual or a newcomer, an immigrant, those individuals will experience discrimination differently depending on the group or what the group that they're in at the time or what they're trying to access. So there is a difference in how individuals are impacted by discrimination. If you have more of your identity is marginalized, and you'll have more significant experiences of discrimination, and you'll have layers of discrimination. So your experiences of those systems will be impacted greatly if you have multiple identities that are marginalized. And so I think that based on that, people will have various experiences of discrimination, and some people may not see the experiences of discrimination as readily as others because of those pieces of privilege, or those are identities that are coming from a place of privilege. So I think that's one of the reasons why there may be a disconnect. And also, there may be a disconnect because, you know, often, and I mentioned earlier about microaggressions. Often, you know, you think, is this really happening? You know, when we talk about racism and discrimination, you know, there's overt experiences where you know for sure this is discrimination. I experienced it. I know that that's, you know, what I'm dealing with based on the questions that I was asked, based on, you know, how I, you know, my experience with this individual. But then there are times where, you know, racism and discrimination is more covert. And so you question, is that what I'm experiencing? Did that person really just say that what I thought they said? So yeah, there, you know, maybe not necessarily disconnect, but an inability to navigate your experience and articulate what it is that you're experiencing as systemic, structurally, or interpersonally, depending on how it's presented to you.
I also see a disconnect between how society deems the more worthy newcomer or the less worthy newcomer, because that's also a form of discrimination where some people view people from certain cultures with more positive or more favorable traits and others less favorable. And even though a group may feel that, well, it's great, I'm, you know, there's a positive trait because of who, you know, because of my background, it's still discrimination. It's still unfair because not everyone falls under a specific assigned trait. And not many people, or at least it's not commonly recognized as discrimination.
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely felt that as a Asian male experiencing the stereotype of having to be smart. As you see, it would be sounding positive, but like you said, Douglas, it's actually still racism or discrimination in a way that is, you know, it is, even though it's positive, it's still hurtful because it is it's a stereotype. And growing up in, you know, the suburbs as well, and understanding what is blatant versus covert was tricky. I think it's only as I grew up and I realized going, wow, these were actually very covert ways of, you know, whether it was the lunch that I had or, you know, things about my appearance or what I chose to listen to. These were small things, but I'm glad we're all here talking today about that. But again, this conversation is definitely focused on housing. So I'd like to actually really get into the discrimination. What does that look like when it comes in terms of the context of housing, and what are some examples of discrimination in housing?
You know, it's it manifests itself just like every other forms of discrimination, sometimes overtly, sometimes it's more subtle. In Mississauga, there was a story in 2016 where there was a Kijiji ad for a basement apartment, and on the ad it read, "Black guys, please no call." And so, you know, that is an example of a very overt type of discrimination. And of course, we have laws that are supposed to prevent that. But oftentimes, it does not manifest itself in that way. What we see more often is landlords who are asking for more than 1 month's rent in advance for newcomers. And they say, well, it's because you don't have a credit rating or credit history, but it's being applied almost strictly for newcomers or people with racialized backgrounds. making it very difficult for them to obtain housing, to go to school, to go to work. You know, discrimination with respect to family status for single parents with children. We often see situations where landlords complain that they rent an apartment to a single parent with one child, and then the family grows, and they say, "Well, you know, you have to find somewhere else to live." So those are a couple of examples that we see in, as examples of discrimination when it comes to housing.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate. There's a lot of research out there. There's a lots of reports and you know, decisions from, you know, the human rights with regards to people's experiences of discrimination in housing. And it's, you know, it can look, it shows up in various ways. And, you know, it's based on people's prejudice. People have prejudged notions or preconceptions, stereotypes, as you spoke about, Axel, about certain groups of people, and it shows up through their actions, which is discrimination. So you have these prejudices, and then it's showing up in through discrimination. So when you are a landlord and you're not willing to rent to Black folks because you believe that, you know, Black folks or Black families are more likely to be involved in, you know, criminal activity or some association with drugs or gun or gang violence, then that's discrimination when you're asking questions that, you know, that are different because you're the person that's wanting to rent from you or wanting to access housing from you is a person from the Black community. Those are inappropriate questions to be asking. Those are prejudgments that you're making based on what you've seen on TV, based on what you see in the media. And we know that that the media, TV, you know, some things are sensationalized. Lots of times you don't get the full picture because individuals that are you know, creating those stories often aren't the people themselves that are identifying as those groups. So from the lens of others, you you have your own perspective and story about what this community looks like and how they live and what their experiences are. And that's not acceptable. And then that, you know, comes through in people's experiences when they're trying to access housing. You know, landlords not willing to rent to brown folks because they believe that they have too many children, or they're concerned about, you know, the number of, you know, family members that will be coming over, you know, for celebrations that are non-Western celebrations. And, you know, these are all things that people experience that as discriminatory, and people, you know, often feel they're entitled to ask certain questions. Some people will say, you know, this is my property, or, I have a right to make these types of decisions. And they're not understanding that they don't have a right to make those decisions or to ask those questions. And so, you know, just as Douglas spoke of, you know, asking individual specific questions because you're questioning their socioeconomic status, or you're seeing them as less worthy as others. Those are all going to have negative impacts on folks, and the level of scrutiny or the degree of scrutiny being different based on your identity, whether it's your race, your class, your sexual orientation, or your ability. You know, those are all things that people need to know about in terms of what their rights are in answering the questions that are being presented to them when they're looking to access housing.
And I also see on a systemic level, levels of discrimination at the municipal level, where you see councillors, for example, recently in the city of Toronto, there was a long debate about legalizing multi-tenant housing in the city of Toronto. And the fear of communities that if you legalize high-density, affordable housing, that it'll bring with it trouble, more crime. You know, those are some of the words that you hear from those communities. And sometimes that's code for, well, we think low-income tenants have these attributes, whether it be racialized, poor, they have large families, or whatever trait that they want to assign them to, manifests itself in pushback on when cities are trying to zone appropriately, trying to make communities safer. So those on a systemic level are forms of discrimination that we've seen.
You know, what Douglas is saying reminds me of a specific discriminatory practice called racial steering, where landlords and housing providers steer people from different ethnic groups and backgrounds to specific neighborhoods or specific areas or buildings. And so, you know, that just brings to mind that practice, which is just as Douglas said, you know, a systemic form of discrimination.
Absolutely. I mean, with all that you both described, there's a lot of practical and emotional impacts of discrimination in the housing market. And I know, Douglas, you touched briefly on it, where it's like you're unable to move or grow your family. I would like if you both could touch upon what those practical and emotional impacts are. You know, how does it really affect, you know, the psychology of people and how, you know, their mental health? Is it the disruption of the community itself? What are these things?
Yeah, I know from my work with Embrave Agency to End Violence, what we do see is people that do not have access as others do. So racialized folks, marginalized folks, not having access to safe and affordable housing. So they're always in precarious, unsafe, unaffordable housing. That affects their abilities to leave an abusive relationship, for example. So if you are in an abusive relationship and you're wanting to access housing and you're discriminated against because of your sexual orientation or because of your identity, then you have less access and less ability to move beyond the violence that you're experiencing. So you are forced, you know, essentially to live in an abusive relationship, to remain in that abusive relationship, and needing to choose between being abused or being homeless or living in poverty. And those aren't decisions that anyone should ever have to make. And so when you don't have equal access to safety or affordable housing, then you are, you know, essentially putting people at risk. And that could be at risk of fatality in some circumstances. And we've seen that in the work that we do at Embrave. So those are significant impacts in people's lives when they're not able to have equal access to safe, affordable housing.
And it's extremely frustrating to see that, in a climate where we're experiencing a significant affordable housing crisis, which existed prior to the pandemic and has only been made worse during the pandemic, that people who are struggling to just get a foothold into a community where they can say, I'm going to put this address on my resume. I'm going to, you know, this is a local school where I can send my kids. They're competing over a small percentage of what many of us would consider affordable with others. And so in a climate with very low vacancy rates, landlords feel emboldened to trample on individuals' rights. And you know, the current political climate and conversations have been centering around supply of home ownership, but really for those who are racialized, marginalized, those who have had challenges finding affordable housing, the easiest and quickest way to put a roof on your head is the rental market. And it's often the gateway to home ownership. So if the affordable rental market disappears or is no longer available for people, that's going to push people to move out of their community in which they were raised, in which they have, you know, connections. And it also creates a sense that, well, if every level of government is focusing on building more condos, then where do I fit in society? And so groups are asking themselves, you know, where do we fit in the conversations? There was a recent Globe and Mail report where they determined what's affordable. So 30% of your income towards shelter is what's deemed affordable. That's the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation's recognition of affordability. And overall, you need at least $70,000 of income every year to rent a one-bedroom apartment in Canada. And that's really out of reach for a lot of people. And that's the rental market. And so the focus on just home ownership and building more homes, you know, has a detrimental effect on many Ontarians and Canadians who feel that, you know, we need affordable rentals now. We can't wait 5 to 10 years when that new building is built down the road. You know, where are my kids going to school? Where can I work? And those are real discussions that isn't happening in our political conversations. And so, you know, people are feeling quite frustrated because it's not a conversation that that our elected officials and political leaders are having right now.
It's just making me shed a tear when you talk about rent in Toronto, because it is ever rough, and those numbers are horrible, because it really does, you know, separate many people from being able to afford housing, and it's extremely sad to hear that. And I hope those conversations happen. But I guess there's a really positive conversation that we can talk about right now, which is both of your experiences that could help out with this, is what if someone, you know, right now is listening and they're experiencing discrimination? You know, what can they do? You know, what legal rights do they have, and who can they turn to for support, especially in the housing area?
Well, there's two places where Ontarians can go to support when they are experiencing discrimination in housing. One being the Landlord and Tenant Board that hears disputes between landlords and tenants, and the Human Rights Tribunal of Ontario that hears human rights complaints. Unfortunately, both tribunals are not functioning properly. The wait at the Human Rights Tribunal is many years, 3 to 5 years before you actually hear your case. And at the Landlord-Tenant Board, the wait is less, but actually ways in which someone can access that tribunal has been made more difficult since the pandemic started. You know, since the pandemic, they have stopped providing any in-person hearings and switched strictly to Zoom. And it's just more challenging for people who have literacy issues, mental health challenges, those who do not speak English or French as their first language, or just lack the equipment, the computer that I'm using to talk to you, the camera that I'm using that I'm using where you can see me, and this mic that I'm talking to with you. They don't have all this equipment. They don't have a room where they can talk about their most personal issues privately, or a data plan, or a phone plan. So what happens at the Landlord-Tenant Board is that tenancies that could otherwise be sustained aren't sustained because people drop out of calls and they issue, and then because they can't get back on, an eviction order is issued, or the adjudicator is watching the conversation happening and determining whether or not this tenant should have their tenancy sustained. But they can't see the tenant's face because they don't have a data plan to engage in the conversation. Meanwhile, the landlord does. So, you know, when you're trying to persuade an independent adjudicator and you can't see one party, but you can see the other, it's almost as if you're putting a tenant into a separate room and the adjudicator is then with the landlord in the same room. So that's a type of disadvantage that we've been seeing since the onset of the pandemic. And that has been challenging. And so the ways in the tenancy laws work in Ontario is that every time a tenancy is vacated, a unit is empty, that unit is then up for, then the landlord can claim whatever they want in terms of rent for that vacant unit. So we're losing an affordable unit every time an eviction takes place, every time a sustainable tenancy cannot be maintained in Ontario, which puts more pressure on the affordable housing crisis. And then down the road, people have their doors closed on them because they can't put up a year's month of rent in advance, or because of how they look, or because of the smell of their cooking, or because of the size of their family. And so, you know, it's all interrelated. But those are the typical legal avenues that tenants have when fighting discrimination cases.
Yeah, and I think you know, what do you do in the meantime, right? When you're sitting there waiting for these cases to be called and you're second guessing yourself already because, you know, discrimination is very difficult to prove. And so you question, you know, whether you have the facts that you need to actually get an outcome that you're looking for. And all the while you're still needing to access safe and affordable housing. So I like to think about, you know, what's happening on the, you know, grassroots community groups, those that will help folks that are going through these situations and supports around them that to help them kind of navigate the challenges and the discrimination that they're experiencing. There's a community group that I'm thinking of that's in Toronto called Renting While Black. It's a Black housing directory with over 2,000 members, including renters, landlords, paralegals, and real estate brokers. And it's an inclusive space where people of color and LGBTQ folks can share their experiences of discrimination while they're seeking housing and connect with landlords and others in an inclusive space. So, you know, you may not seek, you know, justice for what it is that you've experienced, but you can feel supported. You can feel less isolated. You can feel validated, you know, by others that have gone through similar experiences as you. And so that you can, you know, actually get through, because housing is yes, it's a right and it's an important piece, but there's also other systems that you're experiencing discrimination from likely at the same time that is compounding challenges in your life. And how much are you going to take up at any given time, you know? So people do need to feel affirmed in their experiences and they need to feel supported at the same time. The individual that had started that group that I was mentioning, her name was Latoya Williams, and she's someone who has experienced ongoing discrimination during her search for herself and her family to access housing, and a home. So, you know, these types of grassroots social coalitions and things like that are important for supports. At Embrave, we have transitional housing support program staff that will support survivors of gender-based violence access housing supports. And so, you know, those community-led organizations that are supporting individuals with housing are important tools and important resources to have.
And I also want to add, there's a lot of many ethno-cultural centers and community groups in the region of Peel, in the cities of Mississauga, Brampton, Caledon, where people can connect with each other, can find resources, such as the resources that Sharon noted, and can find common space to talk about their issues. And there's lots of agencies that are out there to provide support and housing navigation as well, because, you know, landlords aren't by and large looking to discriminate against people. We're, you know, oftentimes we just focus on the bad apples, but we are aware that, you know, discrimination is a systemic issue. It is still happens in our society. There's also community legal clinics that are funded by Legal Aid Ontario that offers direct support and service for people who are having housing challenges. In Mississauga, there's the Mississauga Community Legal Services. And for Brampton, Caledon residents, there's the North Peel and Dufferin Community Legal Service. They're entrenched in their community, and they have legal experts that offer free services. So those are two additional resources for people who have experienced discrimination.
And in Peel as well, there's the, you know, the Peel Alliance to End Homelessness that that does some advocacy and supports and looking at systems and reducing, you know, the issues or challenges with systems around accessing housing. And there's the Right to Housing Coalition in Peel as well that also does work around, you know, advocacy around accessing housing and systems navigation supports.
And I believe you both already lightly touched on this, but my next question was, what role does a municipality have in remedying, you know, housing discrimination?
I think about the Truth and Reconciliation 94 calls to action. And one of those calls to action is, I believe it's number 57, which is, you know, federal, provincial, and territorial and municipal governments providing training and information to their staff around the history of Indigenous peoples, including the legacy of residential schools and you know, Indigenous rights, Indigenous law, and Aboriginal Crown relations. And I think that, you know, that is a call to action that I think is very relevant here when you're talking about, you know, the First Peoples, for example's experiences accessing various systems in this country. And I think that, you know, those calls to action, I take those calls very, very seriously. I think we all should. And that's an important starting point, that we need to ensure that people are trained on those 94 calls to action. And that particular call to action is about, you know, having a better understanding of the intergenerational trauma that has been experienced by Indigenous folks in this country, and how we can best support those folks in terms of accessing what they rightfully should be accessing, including, you know, accessing housing and safe, you know, drinking water and all those things. Anti-racism, anti-oppression training, I think, is important for those that are making compliance relating decisions. If individuals are claiming experiences of racism and discrimination, then folks that are, you know, taking those claims and processing those claims need to have an understanding of the experiences of those folks. And the only way that that we can ensure that is that they get, you know, that type of training, that, you know, recognizing how to work from an anti-racism, anti-oppression framework, and how to look at decolonizing our practices and our processes. So I think those are important components.
Just to echo on those points, I think training is key. And the Region of Peel is a service manager that oversees nonprofits, co-ops, rent-geared income housing, many, and you know, is supervised many of our housing providers in Peel. They have in the past and should continue offer human rights training for their operators, as well as Peel Housing Corporation, which is the largest rent geared income housing provider in the region. Another way municipalities can act is legalizing their secondary suites or basement apartments to ensure that they meet safety guidelines, that that there's a level of quality and control on landlords who may need that additional training, that human rights training, that anti-racism and anti-oppression type of training when they are providing housing for tenants. That would be helpful as well. And also to ensure that the zoning decisions that they make aren't discriminatory. So those are a couple of ways the municipality can act to ensure that we have a positive and inclusive lens when it comes to housing.
Absolutely. Well, Sharon, Douglas, I want to thank you for your time as well as all the knowledge that you brought to the table here. Again, wish it was in person, but I'm glad we could all speak about such a very, very important topic. For everybody listening at home, you can find information about our podcast at peelregion.ca. And you can join the conversation on the Region of Peel's social media accounts. My name is Axel Villamil, and this was Peel Talks Housing.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of the Region of Peel or the direction provided by the Region of Peel's Council.